Welcome back to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Marco Nunziata, thought leader in economics, innovation, and digital industry. As our world is increasingly digital and increasingly interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, the economy, and policy. And they're also reframing how we innovate and how we build for resilient futures. In this series, brought to you by SocianWorks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, we are exploring these new ecosystemic models and impacts. And over the next two episodes, we'll be continuing our conversation on the world of blockchain, including how it can be applied and its potential impact on the interconnectedness of society as we plan a future that supports greater ecosystemic wellness. My co-host today is somebody who's very well acquainted with the world of blockchain. It's James Villarubia from NASA. Welcome back, James.
Thanks, Marco. Hello, everyone. I'm James Villarubia. I'm currently a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, and I'm working with the teams over there using AI to imagine sort of better futures for humanity and hopefully work in great technologies like blockchain. So I'm really excited to continue our conversation today with our guest.
And our guest today is Anne Connolly, who is faculty at Boston University and one of the foremost leaders in the blockchain space. Anne, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a great pleasure to have a chance to continue our conversation. In the first episode, you talked us through what blockchain is, what Bitcoin is, why they were introduced, and we talked a bit about the potential fields of application, which are many, and some of the obstacles and hurdles to overcome for greater applicability. So the way I would like to start today, Anne, is if we can shift the focus for a minute and actually broaden it to the impact that the blockchain can have on connecting the world in new ways. You touched a bit on it already in the discussion on education, but why don't you tell us more about the role you think blockchain can play here and how essential it can be?
Yeah, one of the things we're seeing with a lot of exponential technologies, when you look at AI, robotics, et cetera, is it's really blowing everything we know apart. The world that we live in is becoming, when you look at ChatGPT and Google Bard and all these different mechanisms, it's really changing everything around us quite quickly. And I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that we still live in a world full of other people, and we still have to coordinate with other people. And I think as these technologies grow at an exponential pace, the ability of governments and some of our pre-existing coordination mechanisms are not going to be able to keep up. And so for me, what's exciting about blockchain is it's going to enable us to try out a whole bunch of new coordination mechanisms and look at what have we done in the past that's worked well, how can we recreate that in an exponential world, and then what's not serving us in this new way. And so I think that's probably for me what's most exciting about it, is really enabling us to reimagine what a society looks like. And that might reimagine it with, you know, AIs or different robots or whatnot as members of this society alongside human beings. But I think it's going to give us some of the tools that we need to actually create the structures so that the whole world doesn't fall into chaos and we can still continue to work together to achieve our goals.
You're talking about the real world, right? And not the metaverse. It's the real world you're talking about.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the metaverse will come into it as well, but I'm still, yeah, the real world is the one I'm probably most afraid of where it's going.
That's great. I really like that concept around sort of coordinating people. That's still a big component of the future. I think people get wrapped around the axle with technology, like, oh, and all these grand things, but the world will still have people in it and people are still going to be, have their sort of core basic needs. Can you talk to me a little bit about, I guess I want to continue our conversation around identity, because I think there's a lot there around sort of the intersection between sort of government needs around identity, particularly internationally, and sort of cross-border relationships and the blockchain or the potential of blockchain to sort of disrupt international identity. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most people don't really think about it, but when I have an identity, it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to the Canadian government, and they can take it away from me at any point in time. And without that identity, I can't access things like moving across borders, maybe I can't access healthcare, whatever it is. And so this idea that somebody else owns who I am is kind of a weird one. It's a bit scary. And so you can get into situations, for example, where in the 1950s and 60s, In America, if you were a communist, you couldn't get a passport. Many women living in the Islamic countries can't get access to identity without permission from a male relative. We saw a case a couple years ago of a young woman named Rahaf Mohammed who fled her abusive family in Saudi Arabia. And when she got to the airport in Thailand, the Saudi government told the Thai government to confiscate her passport and deport her home. And she had to barricade herself in a hotel room, and she's safe now. But had she not taken extreme measures, she would have been deported back, and who knows what would have happened to her. But if this young woman actually owned her own identity, had an identity that was based on blockchain that she can then grow over time, she would have been in a much better place. And so we're seeing groups like Proof of Humanity or Santi Siri and Pia Mancini, who are these two incredible Argentinians that are creating this whole decentralized identity movement. So their daughter Roma was born. And when she was born, they made a video that said, this is Roma. Here's proof of her birth in San Francisco. Here's some witnesses that witnessed the birth. And they uploaded that video to a blockchain. And over time, Roma can add more attestations from people that she meets. She can add more proof, different, maybe a cell phone bill with her name on it or whatever it is, so that over time, her identity becomes stronger and stronger. And so it doesn't mean government will participate in that identity. For example, the government of Brazil is issuing decentralized birth certificates. So you could link that government issued ID to the ID that she herself owns. But the key point there is that no one can confiscate it and no one can turn it off. So if you were a refugee, for example, and you were fleeing and you had nothing but the clothes on your back, as long as you had access to an internet connected device, you could open up your identity for everyone to see and it would be verified and you'd be much more likely to get processed into a new location. So for me, I think just the potential for this is incredible. The potential for what it can do for individuals, particularly as we see a world that's becoming more and more without borders than ever before.
I wanted to follow up on that sort of refugee comment, because I think one of the things, you know, you may be able to talk about this from your experience, and one of the things that's sort of so striking is that when refugees come to these places, I think people assume like, oh, okay, it's just a sort of a transitory place. But in reality, where they're coming from owns their identity. That government that may have fallen or have a coup may have been taking place. They may be a pushed out minority or religious population whose identity they don't want to share anymore. The government says, no, you don't exist. And that's invisible non-identity status of a refugee makes transitioning to another country so much harder, because there's a lot of crime and issues that come up with what happens on campus, how you get to a new place. But having an identity that can't be taken really does, to your point, sort of open up or the ability of a new government, of a new country, to trust that prior history instead of starting from scratch. Like, oh, okay, I see that you were a doctor and you lived here. There's some sort of, and this is your child, this is your wife, et cetera. I mean, those sort of identities can really help stop child trafficking or international sex trade issues. I mean, there are lots of issues that could be really resolved with this. I mean, is that sort of stuff that you're seeing, is that happening now? Are there companies or organizations that are using the blockchain in these capacities, or people trying to, at least maybe on an individual basis?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you're totally right. Like 70% of refugees lack the identity documentation they need to get processed. But more importantly, they lack access to the third party or the intermediary, notably government, to provide that for them. So even if you have a fully functioning country that is happy to grant you an ID, you can't get back there because the office has been bombed out, or you can only do it in person, or it's 5,000 miles away. And so, yeah, from that standpoint, it's critical that it is on blockchain and verified. Now, we've seen the UN is working with World Identity Network to essentially create a system for children. As you mentioned, more than 1.2 million children are trafficked across borders every year. And if these kids had decentralized IDs, perhaps linked to biometric indicators, essentially, the child could only cross a border with someone who is in the inner circle of their attestations. So, for example, parents or grandparents or something like that. And if an attempt was made to traffic them, an immutable record would be made on chain to prove that someone had tried to traffic this child. They were found at this border, and you couldn't just pay off the border guard to make that record go away, because, again, it is immutable and it is power proof. And so these are some of the really neat examples of identity that are happening. And so is it widespread? Can you cross borders with it right now? Absolutely not. It's very early days on the identity front. But we're seeing these decentralized identities being used for entry into conferences. We're seeing it for access to different bonuses as a part of other programs. If you prove, you know, who you are, or at least prove that you are a single individual, then you'll get a bonus as a part of some program. So it's early days, but it's going to, you know, I think we'll see it being, okay, well, now it's your student card. And then next year, maybe the gym nearby gets on board and then the town gets on board and it'll grow. But yeah, still early days, but some very exciting possibilities for the area of decentralized ID.
And you can see how good the conversation is by the fact that James and I are jumping onto each other, trying to ask questions. I actually want to stay onto this topic for a moment, because the issue of the intersection between private and decentralized networks enabled by the blockchain and government, I think, is especially interesting. And I would like to understand from you, do you think that there are reasons to be worried about this? Let me throw out a couple of things. One is, as you mentioned, governments are getting into the game. They participate. They do play a role, including in these identity schemes. If I think back to the world of finance, a number of countries have launched or are studying central bank digital currencies, which have raised the concerns because people argue they might become a way for the government to have complete knowledge and complete control over every transaction that we carry out and everything we do. We've also seen governments being very interested in immutable records that they then use to condition our movements. We've seen COVID passports during the pandemic and restrictions on travel. And as you mentioned, the issue in a positive way, situation where you can't anymore just bribe a border guard. I can envision situations where being able to bribe a border guard might actually be good. So help us think through this, the risks and benefits balance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to me, CBDCs, the central bank digital currencies, are one of the scariest things out there. The ability for a government to track and trace absolutely every single transaction that you make. And in some countries, maybe the risk to citizens is lesser, but let's say you're in a country where women's rights are not good or gay rights are not good, and you want to make a donation to an organization that's fighting government on those points. Government has access to every single transaction, your life is at risk. And that's really dangerous and really scary. So there's certain, I think for me, that's where I like to push the applications in blockchain and crypto that are public and open and, again, not managed by government. But at the end of the day, these governments are going to come out with them and they will be very easy to use and all the nice things that citizens like and quote unquote trusted for people who are used to trusting centralized governments. And so that's where I think education around what the risks and rewards are is going to be absolutely critical. But you're right, there certainly will be cases where maybe there are restrictions on how people can get in and out of different biz or things they might have been able to do they can't do anymore. And that will have downsides. If you look at, people will often say, well, what if you're allowed to do illegal things? And I say, well, illegal where, right? There's haircuts that are illegal in North Korea. There are, you know, certain places where just because something is legal doesn't mean it's good. And that, I think, will be the downside to some of this, is perhaps there will be more control over things that might have had a bit more leeway historically. But we'll just have to see how that plays out.
I'm not too worried about the haircuts, but I leave it to James.
Well, it sounds like there's a distinction here, which I think is worth sort of drawing out, is that, I mean, governments today can do that. If they wanted to, they could institute sort of very strict identity controls. Maybe the technology hasn't been as robust, but you know, you could do that. You could outlaw haircuts and then track every haircut, but it's just been harder. And I think it sounds like sort of blockchain is making that a little bit easier to do, but it's that sort of injecting back that centralization, injecting back that power dynamic within the transaction space, but forcing the transparency. But it sounds like, I mean, I guess I'm reading that the real power to sort of reshape sort of our future is where those sort of bigger ideals around sort of transparency, sort of international or sort of shared governance really does become a sort of bottoms up. Is that, oh, people are voting? Because I know there's sort of concepts of liquid democracy and DAOs that really sort of maybe represent the opposite side of that. Could you talk a little bit more about the governance shapes in sort of these future ecosystems that maybe are cross-border that may counteract or hopefully will counteract some of these tendencies towards centralization with this tech?
Yeah. So if you look at our governance structures that we have today, I mean, essentially they were created in, I don't know, the 1700s or whatever, at a time when you had to get on a horse to go and represent the people in your town to the central body that was managing your country. That just doesn't really apply to the world we live in today. And with the advent of technology, and particularly internet, but now with blockchain, the ability for people to have a greater voice more often is here. And so this is where we're seeing the development of something called DAOs, or decentralized autonomous organizations. It sounds really fancy. All it is essentially a group of people that want to achieve something together. And their goal might be pooling their money to invest in different projects. It might be that they just want a more democratized way to manage their HOA or to come together as a social club. But in today's world, if you have people coming together to do something, if there's money involved, you have to at some point trust one of the members to manage that money. They're putting their name on the bank account. And if you're voting, there needs to be a way for those votes to be trusted, essentially. And, you know, if you've got a group of 10 people, maybe that's not a problem. But as your group grows to 100, to 1,000, to 10,000, and it becomes more people that are all over the world, maybe they, you don't know them well, it's harder and harder to build that trust. And so essentially DAOs are groups that leverage blockchain technologies to create that trust. So all of the treasury that they have is held in crypto, and you would need multiple signatures to release the funds. Perhaps the funds could only be released as a result of a vote, and all the votes are transparent. So you get this incredible trust in a vote, knowing that it couldn't be hacked into in some sort of centralized software. And there's some examples of really cool things that people are doing with DAOs. So we've seen certainly a lot of decentralized venture capital DAOs. BitDAO in particular is one that has over $2.5 billion worth of assets that they're investing into different crypto companies to help grow the ecosystem. We've seen DAOs that are just designed to help more women get into the blockchain space. It's a social place where they can come. They grant to different women-based projects. One you may have heard of in the news was Constitution DAO, which is essentially someone found out that a copy of the Constitution was going up for auction. And they thought it was a really weird thing that one rich person could have access to this document that represents so many people. So they were able in 48 hours to bring 17,000 people together, raise $47 million with the hopes of a collective buy of this piece of the Constitution. Now, I wish I could say it was a fairy tale ending. They did not win the auction. One of the reasons for that was very sadly that the funding that they had was transparent and anyone else could see exactly how much money they had to bid with. But one of the neat things that you'd mentioned about DAOs was this idea of liquid democracy. And so this concept that, let's say we're a group and we're voting on two things, and one of them is climate related and one of them is economy related. And I could say, listen, I'm an expert on the economy, but James, you're an expert on climate, and I really just trust what you think on this issue. I can give my voting power to you on that issue. And then if I don't like the way you vote, I can actually take it back at any point of time. And so this is really enabling people incredible flexibility in the decision making they have. Now, the downside to some of that is in these sort of large groups of people, sometimes people will delegate their votes to others. And you, instead of getting a massively decentralized version of coordination, the voting power becomes increasingly centralized because you maybe four or five people have 80% of the voting power. So there's kinks to work out, but DAO's abilities to bring people from all over the world together to very quickly achieve goals is something we've never seen before. And it's something I'm very excited to see where it goes in the future.
Yeah, I think some of the criticisms I've heard about sort of liquid democracy is like, oh, well, is my vote sellable, et cetera, which I think is sort of ironic because I mean, that exists in the current system. We talk about, oh, we have anti-bribery laws with Congress and whatnot, but we still sort of, we can look through history and find that those laws have not necessarily always been enforced as strictly as we'd like. And we also have issues with recalls where we elect someone and they switch parties is coming around the news a lot, representatives switching parties. And I wonder what those populations who voted for someone expecting a certain sort of outcome to champion certain issues, how they would like to be able to sort of recall, pull that liquid democracy, pull that power back and assign it very quickly, as opposed to having to wait either for a recall election, which may never happen, or for 6 years for a senator to have to run for re-election again. So I think there are some really powerful ideas in this liquid democracy space. But yeah, I'm excited to see sort of how it shapes out in reality, because there are obviously a lot of kinks to this, as with all new technologies.
And again, probably a good point to pause and end our second episode. discussion has been especially fascinating for me today. What I liked the most was that whenever we discuss a new technology, there is a question mark on whether the technology itself will really change things or whether it's just going to replay the usual issues of human natures and incentives in a different way. And I think in the conversation today, you've given us a very good sense of what the technology enables in a very different way, this greater transparency, this greater scope for a broader, more decentralized international cooperation, the idea of immutable identity records that are now owned by the individual rather than being completely at the mercy of the state, I think is very powerful. So to me, this was a fantastic conversation. And the biggest takeaway for me is that here we have a technology which is potentially very disruptive, but it requires a lot of attention in thinking through the consequences as different private and public players get involved. James, how do you view our conversation today?
I really like to sort of echo your point, Marco. I think that what really struck me today was that was sort of the end point around sort of power and size naturally leading towards centralization, just given sort of the technology of yesteryear, where you had to get on a horse and buggy to vote a representative. So these mechanisms existed because of the nature of the world. And we finally have a chance, it sounds like, with blockchain to maybe swing the pendulum a little bit the other way. Of course, that's not perfect, but there's at least the potential, if we could figure out to use this technology to really enable sort of greater or more transparent, sort of more fluid and responsive democracies and governments. And I think that's really powerful to sort of see where that goes. So that's what got me excited.
That is excellent. We've both been very excited. And in the third episode of this series, we will dive deeper into what the future looks like and how blockchain can really enable a different future, under what conditions and in what ways. But for now, Anne, thanks very much. It was a great conversation. Thanks for coming back to us. And we really look forward to having you back on the mic for the third episode soon.
Thanks for having me.